The Irish Times Business Podcast in association with Irish Life.
Supporting companies and their employees for 75 years. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life.
Hello and welcome to Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock, a podcast from the Irish Times. Later in the show, we'll be examining EirGrid's report into how electricity should be generated here in 20 years' time. Kevin O'Sullivan of the Irish Times will give us his view on this crucial issue. And Barry Halloran of the Irish Times will also take us through the aviation regulator's decision on passenger charges for Dublin Airport, which the DAA has described as a disaster for the economy. But first, Laura Slattery joins me in studio to run through some of the major business stories of the week. Laura, you're very welcome. And we're going to start with Google and yet more expansion in Dublin. Tell us about that.
That's right. Yeah, Google is taking over even more office space in the city, aka Google Town. It's going to rent, or it's certainly in talks to rent, 202,000 square foot at the sorting office, which is in the Dublin Docklands, not that far from its cluster of buildings, existing buildings here. So
it's on Cardiff Lane, which many people might be familiar with, runs from the Quays down to Pierce Street.
So it's very near the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre, but it's also quite close to the HQ of companies like Facebook and Airbnb, and of course Google itself. I mean, I could list through all the different buildings that Google currently rents in Dublin, but I'd be here for some time if I did.
But they're spreading their wings a little bit because they've built this kind of campus, I suppose, around Barrow Street. If people know it, it's quite close to Ring's End, not far from the Aviva Stadium as well. But they've moved out to Sandyford and elsewhere now, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I should say that both this story about Google renting this block now on Cardiff Lane and a recent story about Sandyford, as you say, they're from our Irish Times deputy property editor, Ronald Quinlan. He's been reporting on this. And Sandyford was sort of seen as, oh, well, yeah, branching out, as you say. But this new one, I suppose, is a kind of a confirmation that it really sees the city centre, the Docklands area, as its sort of main hub. Its biggest investment in the Dublin office market actually came last year, where there was a $300 million deal to acquire the whole Boland's Quays scheme. So it's really, this is giving Google the opportunity to expand its workforce here from about 8,000 up to about 10,000, we think, which is a pretty huge number of employees to have in the city. Though it should be said that globally, Google is totally expanding at a rapid rate. It actually hired 6,500 new workers just in the last quarter. It now employs 114,000 people totally across the globe, and that's up 20,000 year on year. So this is a really fast, fast expanding business.
Yeah, good for Ireland, obviously. A lot of jobs. I mean, they're well-paid jobs, good jobs, etc. But should the day ever come, of course, let's hope it doesn't, but if Google were ever to pull out of this market, obviously it would leave a big hole behind it. But anyway, let's hope that's not going to happen. Now, let's talk about banking. And KBC had a report out this week on home buying trends.
That's right. Another interesting survey from KBC Bank, just looking at home buyer behaviour and how it's changed. And their chief economist, Austin Hughes, he says, you know, he's detecting a kind of increasing tendency among buyers to want to future-proof their home purchases. So essentially, two-thirds of people intend to live in the property they buy for more than 10 years, which is a sort of a rising percentage. And he's saying that's down to sort of people, they're more likely to want to seek the sort of the home of their dreams, sort of the perfect home. You know, if they can't afford to get on the ladder at all, they want to get on a ladder in a way that they're not going to have to upgrade again, you know, go up the ladder step by step. Because over the last 10 to 15 years, there's been an incredible amount of difficulty in doing that. People have seen quite a lot of dysfunction in the market. It's hard to, you know, once you buy somewhere, it hasn't always been easy, you know, I guess, through the crash and the sort of legacy of negative equity to take that next step. So we saw people who may be buying smaller properties that needed to expand when their family expanded and weren't always able to do so because of the economic situation, but also because there's particular, I guess, transactional kind of difficulties in the market as well. People aren't really racing to get back into that. So they want to buy and be able to live there for as long as they possibly can.
Yeah, which isn't unreasonable, I guess. Brexit, I suppose, has been weighing somewhat on the Irish property market. And of course, we know now that uncertainty is going to continue until the end of January, at least because of this extension that's been granted by the European Union. And we have a general election coming up in Britain.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, you know, that you know, these are contributing to nervousness in consumer sentiment as well, which is another factor. The fact that house prices aren't going up at the same rate that they were, in fact, they're falling in Dublin, is also another reason I guess people feel content to sit back and wait and not compromise in the way that they might have done at a time when things are getting a little bit hot and feverish.
Yeah, sure. Okay, now let's go luxury. And the luxury goods group LVMH has bid to take over the US publicly quoted jeweler Tiffany's for a mere $14.5 billion. Give us the backdrop to this, Laura.
Yeah, so LVMH, it's already the biggest luxury goods group in the world. So it's Louis Vuitton, Moët & Chandon, Champagne, Hennessy, Cognac. It also owns Christian Dior, jewellers like Bulgari, watchmaker like Tag Heuer. And the head honcho there is Europe's richest man. That's Bernard Arnault, Frenchman. It's a Paris listed group. And he could, in fact, if you know this deal goes through, he could actually wind up being the richest man in the world, because he's already worth about $97 billion. So it's only Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates who are ahead of him. And he's got his eye on Tiffany's. He sees the nice sparkly jewellery in the window. And, you know, they're a famous company. Some might say iconic. We're not supposed to use that word, but anyway.
We will, yeah.
They, of course, had their own starring role in the book and film Breakfast at Tiffany's, and it's associated with New York, Fifth Avenue. You know, they effectively popularized the concept of diamond engagement rings throughout the 20th century. So they're a very attractive, you know, target for acquisition. And one of the things, you know, they've said now that, you know, they're reviewing the offer. But one of the things LVMH move might do is actually flush out some rival suitors. So it's not a done deal. There may well be a couple of other European luxury
goods
groups.
Well, mind you, with a price tag of $14.5 billion, there can't be too many suitors, other suitors out there. And possibly not great news for consumers of these luxury products, because obviously LVMH is going to have to get its money back, and which might mean higher prices at the till.
Well, it might do, but I suppose the real bet for all of these companies is China. So they're looking at the sort of expanding group of consumers. I guess they're looking at a group as well that's maybe not so price sensitive as, you know, you would find in other types of retail. So you know, Kering, for example, they own Gucci and Yves Saint Laurent, and Richemont, the watchmaker, you know, they may be sort of circling around this too. But certainly, you know, Tiffany's, it's a company, as I said, that dates back to the 1830s. It's could be a very nice prize for somebody.
OK, we'll see how that plays out. Laura Slattery, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Now, earlier this week, Airgrid, which manages the electricity transmission system here, produced a report on Ireland's electricity generation over the next 20 years. And it's come up with three scenarios. Kevin O'Sullivan of the Irish Times covered the story and he joins me here in studio. Kevin, you're very welcome. Just take us through, first of all, maybe just give us the backdrop to how electricity in Ireland is generated at present.
Yeah, well, Airgrid is responsible really for the transmission system, and that means that it has to have the structure in place to deliver electricity to the key points from where it's generated. Now, the ESB then takes it over and is responsible for distribution. So separately then, Airgrid provides power to big energy consumers as well, like industry, and you can see the big demand that's emerging, for example, in data centers, and that has to be sort of factored in its development. But the given its role in Ireland, we're only one part of the island, and it has a Sony in the north, which is its equivalent in the north, and that it's envisaged will operate in complementing the whole island in terms of the role in terms of the transmission system. But there's two big overriding things that are kicking in, and that is the demanding energy targets, notably renewable energy targets that are coming from the EU, and also our climate obligations. Now, those have been stepped up further again by the government adopting its climate action plan. And again, the EU is stepping up ambition in the period up to 2030. So Airgrid in its wisdom, has seen this emerging. But also, you're talking about a scenario where there's much more demand for power in coming decades. We have a growing economy, probably. We have a growing population, certainly for the next few decades. So that these are big factors that that kick in.
And it's all about sustainability, isn't it? You know, some of this electricity that we're generating at the minute is actually coal powered, isn't it?
It's fueled
by coal, essentially.
Yeah, it is indeed. And peat, now, both those are no-nos in a sense in terms
of
climate. Dirty fuels, we have to get out of them as quickly as possible while, you know, maintaining support for communities that are going to be impacted in the Midlands or in County Clare, where Moneypoint is going to stop using coal. We don't know exactly what future role it will have, but that's in the short-term horizon. So Moneypoint will stop using coal by 2025, if not sooner. And peat, likewise, in terms of power stations in the Midlands. So the demands in terms of using renewables are, meanwhile, stepping up. And in fairness to Airgrid, they have had notable success in taking renewables onto the electricity grid, and it's quite remarkable what they're already achieving.
And that's 25-30%.
Yeah, it's very impressive on a global scale. But what's kicking in now is a specific measure in the Climate Action Plan, that is to have 70% of electricity from renewable sources by 2030. That's a hugely demanding target that is concentrating minds. So this was a key sort of driver in terms of, you know, them looking forward over the next few decades, notably out to 2040, in terms of how the market might change. And so they engaged in this big this consultation process, which was, you know, good engagement with the industry and with others. And then they had four scenarios, and one very quickly it was clear was just not sufficient in terms of pace of change and adaptation of renewable energy, so that was dropped. So the report that they have published this week, which is called Tomorrow's Energy Scenarios, comes up with three, and they're very interesting scenarios. It's well worth anyone interested in are in the energy business delving into them. But two of them will achieve that 70% target by 2030, but in different kind of ways. And one of them is the failure, and that's described in the report as delayed transition. So where the transition to renewable energy, to decarbonisation, just doesn't happen. People acknowledge that there's climate change and we must change, but in reality, they don't change.
So how do we get to the 70% level? What's Airgrid's view on this?
Well, the two scenarios are quite different, actually, and the outcome is largely the same in terms of achieving that scenario by 2030. But the first one they've classified as centralised energy, and that's where we achieve that big aim of, you know, decarbonising Ireland and moving quickly to a low carbon future. That's probably the best way of describing it. And there's a significant step change in terms of electrification of transport, in terms of heating, in terms of using heat pumps in homes instead of fossil fuels, and combined with energy efficiency, and you know, that there's a significant uptake of the options that are there. But the key thing in that scenario is there's still big generators, you know, generating the bulk of the fuel, whether it's wind, solar or gas or whatever. You know, that they dominate this planned kind of environment. And so the one significant element that they identify in that is offshore wind. And, you know, the potential for that is very, very significant. There's no doubt about that.
But we're starting to see a number of projects off
of Ireland. Now, there's big issues around planning to get, you know, accelerated development of it. But the potential is really there. There's no doubt about that. And there's an International Energy Agency report this week confirming that. It's quite phenomenal, the pricing changes that are going to happen, but also what it can generate in terms of other fuel sources. But another element in that sort of scenario is that carbon capture and storage technology is beginning to be rolled out. But, you know, unfortunately, we're not there yet. So that's sort of somewhere down the road, but clearly it happens. So the other scenario which gets you to that point in 2030 is the coordinated action, as they call it. And that is a very interesting difference because it's less of the big players and more of the engaged consumers, the engaged citizens that are participating in the energy system. You know, they're using smart technology to control when they get electricity. They're part of the micro generation club in terms of generating locally and getting paid for it, remarkably, in contrast to what happens now. But you can see the obvious sort of synergies then with communities, sports clubs, schools, small businesses tapping into that market, and you know, there's big things that sort of help it, like artificial intelligence, really good smart technology, and the Internet of Things. So that's, you know, it's a different emphasis, but it still gets you there. And that particular scenario is interesting because they classify that as the one where there is highest demand for power as well.
Yeah, okay. Now, they came up with three scenarios, but they didn't actually make any recommendations. Why not?
No. Well, I think, you see, Mark Foley puts it very well. There's a whole lot of factors. There's no certainty in this because you could have political issues that might intervene. Technology might develop, you know, in a certain way. You have environmental factors. You know, standards might get more demanding. You know, renewable energy targets might become more.
Sure,
more
but it surely has to be policy driven. It has to be the government.
It has.
Laying down the policy and requiring others to follow.
Yeah, unquestionably. But what I would sense in terms of that is that I think the government, notwithstanding the good elements of the Climate Action Plan, will have to step up its ambition in the next decade because we're going to have huge problems in turning our emissions down in terms of going up, in contrast to going up as they are at present.
Right. What happens if we fail? If we don't meet these targets, we don't get 70% by 2030, what happens?
Well,
what are the consequences?
There's lots of consequences in terms of fines, but there would be huge pressure on Airgrid in particular, and then the likelihood if they don't sort of act on these scenarios and stress test the system in terms of generating, in terms of what the demand is going likely to be, but also in terms of future need, you know, then the instability of the system kicks in, and no one wants that in a developed economy. And I think that's the point of this exercise. It sort of reduces the risk. It gives you a degree of certainty, notwithstanding the fact that there'll be other factors that will come into play. Like there'll be some technology that we didn't anticipate in 10 years' time that is really helpful. So, you know, this is probably the best way of anticipating the likely scenario. Clearly, I would think, I don't know, but I would envisage that Airgrid would want either one or three scenarios that work. And they will now be put through a rigorous sort of testing in terms of scenarios out to 2040. And then they will come back. You know, this is the next phase is what's called a special needs assessment, you know, testing, you know, how the grid is operated and then the actual capacity of the grid itself in the context of all that kind of demand. So that'll be the very interesting next step. But I think you will see it narrowing in terms of going a certain course. But, you know, clearly there's issues around demand. There's issues around, you know, the generation of power itself. There's issues around interconnection, what role that plays. And I think, obviously, in a European context, that is very important to us.
Sure, and we're getting an interconnector with France, aren't we, which has been heavily subsidised by the European Union. Now, consumers might wonder, what is all of this going to mean for me in my pocket? Because they probably feel that electricity prices have only been going one way over the last number of years, and that's up.
Yeah, well, they're right to think that, and that has been the hard thing about it. But I think when you look at the costs, particularly in relation to wind and particularly in relation to offshore, that you're going to see a significant reduction in electricity. I don't think any doubt about that.
In the cost of electricity?
In the cost, yes.
I
don't know, but it'll take time. And then obviously there are certain subsidies and PSO issues around a certain fuel and all that kind of stuff. You know, there are issues around carbon tax as well. So if you're using renewables and you will have an increased opportunity to use renewables, you're going to get very significant benefit in terms of price.
All right. What happens to this report now? Does this feed into government policy in any way?
Well, I'm sure it will, but I think it primarily it's an exercise for AirGrid, and I think, you know, it will ensure that it's in a robust sort of frame for the coming decades.
Right. And how do we fare against our peers internationally in terms of our use of renewables at the moment?
Well, in terms of grid, I think we're a global leader, there's no doubt about that, in terms of being able to take those sort of disruptive elements of power, like sun when the sun shines and wind when the wind blows at a particular time. And there's a very interesting target that's highlighted in this report, and that is that by 2030, at any one point, the grid would be able to take up to 95% of those sort of non-synchronous sources of energy, such as wind and solar. That's in contrast to the more synchronous ones, which would be gas, or, you know, the stable source of power that you can just switch on whenever you need it.
Yeah.
So that is another indication of big ambition.
All right, Kevin, look into your crystal ball now and tell us, how many more years are we going to be using dirty fuels to generate electricity in Ireland?
I think electricity will probably become the sort of best in class in the next 15 years. I genuinely believe that. I think there are problem areas elsewhere, in, say, for example, in transport. I think there's a risk that the conversion to electrified transport and adoption of EVs won't happen at the rate that's been predicted. In other words, 1 million vehicles on Irish roads, 1 million EVs by 2030. I think you have a scenario where fossil fuels will be used in transport to a very significant degree, because of, you know, it takes time for vehicles to turn over to a better mode of transport up to 2040. So the fossil fuel will be a dominant fuel source, unfortunately, for some time to come.
All right, Kevin O'Sullivan, thank you for joining us. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll be talking about passenger charges at Dublin Airport. Back in a few moments.
Only 29% of us know how much we need to live on in retirement. Irish Life is changing that with Empower, a new approach to company pensions that helps change the way your employees think about their future. For more, go to irishlifeempower.ie or talk to your pension consultant. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life. Irish Life Assurance PLC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. All information sourced for Irish Life, June 2015.
Welcome back to this Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock. Now, last Thursday, the aviation regulator decided to reduce passenger charges at Dublin Airport by 11% on average to 787 ahead over the next 5 years. Now, this should be good news for passengers in terms of lower airfares, but it has enraged the DAA, which manages the airport. The DAA says it will harm its chances of being able to raise sufficient debt to fund a €2 billion upgrade of the airport's facilities, which is much needed. Now, Barry Halloran of the Irish Times has been following this story for some time, and he joins me in studio now. Barry, you're very welcome.
Hey, Ciarán.
Give us the backdrop to this. Every 5 years, we have these rulings by the aviation regulator on passenger charges at Dublin Airport.
Yeah. Well, the Commission for Aviation Regulation sets the charges for Dublin Airport. Dublin Airport is by far and away the biggest airport in the island. And therefore, its charges have to be regulated, because it accounts for sort of 30 of 35 million
It's a consumer
passengers.
Protection mechanism, I guess you could
essentially,
say.
Essentially, yeah. And what happens is that the CAR, every 5 years, makes a proposal to cut charges. It then invites submissions from all interested parties, including DAA, the airlines, so on and so forth. It then makes a decision, taking some of that into account and taking some other factors into account. And it made its decision last week. It essentially, it's 787 on average over 5 years, but that's actually going down to 750 for the first 2 years. So in 2020 and 21, it's 750 ahead. And then it rises
over the following years.
Over the following 3 years, to 832, I think.
In the preliminary decision, if you like, they had decided that it should be 750 per year over the course of the 5 years. So they've actually, in effect, they've increased it, haven't they?
Yes, they have increased it. There were a couple of reasons for that. And the main one was that they allowed Dublin extra cash for operating costs. Now, they want Dublin Airport to seek more efficiencies, to cut costs, in other words. But they do see the general operating costs going up over a five-year period. So they added a few cent per head for that. They then took some away. This is a very kind of finely balanced thing, quite obviously. They then took some away to factor in that Dublin Airport now makes quite a lot of money from commercial revenues. That's the money it makes from shops and so forth and restaurants that are operating there.
Mm. It makes quite a lot of money. I mean, I think it's something of the order of 1.4 billion is what Carr is predicting over the 5-year period, which is
not bad.
Which is substantial. It's on a level with what it's going to actually collect in airport charges. Now, the DAA is not happy, and I suppose on one level you can understand why, because the charge was previously 881 under the formula that has existed for the previous period, and it's coming down. But then again, you know, the number of passengers is increasing. I think it's going to go up by about a million or so a year. So, you know, what's their beef?
Essentially, Dublin Airport was looking for 965 a head, if you like. That is what it was charging in 2018. And it maintains that if it were allowed to keep that charge, no change, not going up or down, over the 5-year period from, you know, 2020 to 2024 inclusive, this would allow it to essentially pay for much needed extension work at the airport. That's new boarding gates, new piers, new parking stands.
New security as well.
New security. Everyone is aware that, like, Dublin Airport's is literally bursting at the seams, as you point out in your column this morning. But not only is it bursting at the seams, if you like, in the terminal and in the places where the people catch, you know, embark and disembark, it's also bursting at the seams out in the runway, where aircraft have to wait to buy their time to park when they land and to take off again when they're departing. So Dublin Airport recognises that it has to tackle all of this, and it intends doing that by extending piers at the northern and southern flanks of the airport, if you like. And it needs about 1.8 billion to 2 billion to do that. It says it can do it at 965 a head. It can raise the cash, and it guarantees that there will be no increase. It's also said that the airlines have already agreed to this, and they agreed to this in discussions in 2018. And that's primarily why it's now raging at the regulator. I think they probably felt that the regulator would agree that this was a sensible approach as well.
And yet the regulator has disagreed with that.
Quite strongly, actually.
And they took some independent financial advice before making their final decision. And that advice, in essence, it's quite complicated. It's very technical. But in essence, it said there should be some flexibility over the 5 years, and recommended that the price be lifted, which it was. And I think it also suggests that maybe there might be scope for an interim review. So if some external event were to happen that were to impact on DAA, that the regulator might go back and say, OK, yeah, look, you can increase it. I think it's fair enough. You will need to do that, etc.
Yeah. Well, and what's actually sprung from that is this thing that the CAR has called stage gating. In other words, as Dublin Airport works through its programme of works, works through these extensions, it will at certain points sit down and talk to the airlines and talk to the regulator and, you know, review how progress is going and look at what they need to do and what has transpired in the previous year. So, as you say, some unexpected external event were to affect its fortunes one way or the other, all that would be taken into account. And that's where you would then get your wriggle room. It's not a million miles away from something that Aer Lingus proposed when this was first mooted in back in May. Aer Lingus said, well, we actually think Dublin Airport can do it at the reduced charges, but we would be, on the basis of independence advice, we would be quite happy if they were to increase it towards the end of this 20 to 24 period, if it were to turn out to be necessary for some reason. But that would all have to be measured and gauged independently.
And interestingly, the DAA has kind of said that, well, there's a reduction in the passenger charge coming. However, the difference between what people have been paying to date and what they're due to pay over the next 5-year period will simply be pocketed by a lot of these foreign-owned airlines, which seem to me to be a dig at Aer Lingus, which is now owned by IAG, led by Willie Walsh, registered in Spain, but based in the UK.
Yeah, I think it's partly a dig at them. You could also argue that a lot of Ryanair's shareholders aren't Irish. In fact, there's a lot of them in the States, and a lot of them are European. And they're the big players in the capital markets with whom we're all fairly familiar. So it could equally be seen as a dig at them. Ryanair and Aer Lingus are the two biggest.
What have they been saying about this decision? What does Ryanair think of this proposed reduction?
Ryanair is particularly annoyed. They actually think that the CAR is letting DAA off lightly because the CAR...
It wants lower charges.
Yeah, the CAR originally proposed 750 a head, and Ryanair is saying that, well, the CAR has backed away from that decision, and that's they actually wanted the straight 750 ahead over the next 5 years. And they argued that Dublin Airport, contrary to what DAA itself says, is a very expensive airport from which to operate. Aer Lingus are much more sanguine. They're quite happy with what the CAR has decided. And that's not surprising, given that it at least it reflects some of that airline's thoughts on the whole issue.
Sure. Okay, so where does it go from here? DAA does have the possibility of appealing this decision.
Okay, yeah, well, there is a potential next step. The DAA can go to the minister and say, we want you to convene an independent panel to look at this. And essentially, that kind of starts the process all over again. The DAA goes in and makes its case to the panel and says the CAR got it wrong. Everyone else involved can equally can make their submissions to the panel then, and the panel can rule one way or the other. There may be a judicial review route open to the DAA as well. But my understanding is that the panel appeal system, that's going to take about 6 months. Now, we're running into November. So let's say, for argument's sake, you know, you could be looking June, July before that's finally over. The DAA has, I think, up to 2 months to decide on whether it's
going to be. What happens in the meantime in terms of charges?
The reductions as demanded by the CAR will apply. Should the appeal panel actually turn around and say, do you know what, the DAA is right? Or should the appeal panel turn around and say, well, actually, the DAA deserve a few more quid? The DAA will then be able to claw that back from the airlines afterwards in the latter part of the year, the latter part of next year.
Right. So it sounds like a messy process. Do we know where Shane Ross, the Minister for Transport, stands on all this?
In broad terms, Ross made a policy statement a few years ago where he said that he wanted regulation of Dublin Airport to take the consumers' needs and to prioritise the consumers' needs. Currently, under the law, the minister can intervene and tell the regulator, you must take DAA's financial needs into account.
Ross, and they've done that in the past.
They've done that in the past. Ross hasn't done it this time around. That option is there for him, but the law doesn't oblige him to do it. So Ross hasn't done it this time. So I would say his actions would indicate, and clearly the policy statement he made a few years ago would indicate, that he's more likely to favour this than not favour this.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, listen, we'll see where that lands in the future. All right. Barry Halloran, thank you for joining us. That's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Laura Slattery, Kevin O'Sullivan and Barry Halloran. Declan Conlon produced the show with JJ Vernon as sound engineer. Remember, you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com. And you can also follow the Irish Times business feed on Twitter and Facebook each day. I'm Ciarán Hancock. Until next time, take care.